The Athletic.
I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
He's round the goalkeeper, he's done it! Absolutely incredible!
He launched himself 6 feet into the crowd and kung fu kicked a supporter who was without a shadow of a doubt giving him lip.
Does it tame and tame and tame again?
Crank up the music! Charge your glass! This nation is going to dance all night!
The anatomy of an injury crisis, the dying art of throwing your season ticket at a beleaguered head coach, the dreaded vote of confidence. I've never walked away from anything in my life and I'm not going to start now. The art of sacking a manager and the three types of caretaker. Brought to your ears by The Athletic, this is Football Clichés and part two of the 12 stages of a club crisis. Hello everyone and welcome to episode 93 of the Football Clichés podcast. We're mid-crisis, but boy are we going to see it through with the help of club crisis connoisseurs Jack Pitbrook and Phil Hay. So, your team are playing shit, manager's methods have been questioned, he's lost the dressing room, there is no catch-up, or there is catch-up, we can't decide. To turn the screw, Phil, an injury crisis. Very much, I mean, this can happen any time, and it's never your fault, really, unless, of course, your methods have lent themselves to it.
What about a manufactured one, though? Do you remember the story of the Charlton Six?
No.
Oh. The six players at Leeds who, on a Friday, were suddenly declared unfit and unavailable. In what was, well, everybody denied this, but what seemed to be a protest against Neil Redfern, including one of the players who was seen vaulting a fence before coming up the stairs to tell him that he had a muscle strain and wasn't fit to play.
That's harsh.
As Steve Morrison famously said, this club, Jesus Christ. So those six players missed the trip down to Charlton.
What were the official reasons for these? What were the little injuries in brackets after each name?
There was a back injury with Marco Silvestri that looked like a line of lipstick, it has to be said.
Backs are always good.
Somebody had there were muscular strains, obviously. I mean, you know, it's kind of nondescript muscular strains. The medical staff insisted that they were all unfit, we weren't so sure. And Redfern was gone within months.
So, Jack, if we were to implement a threshold for an injury crisis, because, again, it's a phrase I don't want thrown around willy-nilly. Is it a number of injuries? Is it injuries in a certain area?
I'd say that one section of your team would have to be described as makeshift.
Yeah.
Ideally, the defence or the midfield. I've got no sympathy for a makeshift front line, and you can always find a teenager who can score goals. But yeah, if you have to have a makeshift defence or a makeshift midfield, and that's a crisis. So I guess that means somebody playing out of position, a teenager, someone who's rubbish and hasn't played in years. And, you need, like, basically a kind of strange group of people thrown together just to be this makeshift back four for this one game. You know,
Oddly enough, this kind of, this sealed the title for them. But it's the sort of scenario where Rangers are signing Andy Dibble and Mark Haley on pay-as-you-play deals to get them through an Old Firm derby. I think that's kind of injury crisis. That was in kind of a good moment for them, but that's the sort of thing that would make you think trouble afoot.
Yeah, definitely. If you're drafting an emergency signing, so I would say the lowest threshold is no fit senior centre-backs.
Mm-hmm.
That's the phrase I would use. Then it goes to not being able to fill your bench. And that's actually quite, it's just a sad situation, isn't it? You know, laughable, two bob, not being able to fill your bench with subs. Having to get special dispensation to sign a goalkeeper, that's when it gets really bad. But always fun for a story. And then someone having to re-register as a player.
Yes.
Especially
if it's the manager.
Yes. That's what I want to happen in the Premier League this season. A manager having to re-register himself. Which manager is the most feasible re-registration as a player?
I literally can't even think. Sean Dyche. Yes. Definitely. He'll still back himself. Yeah.
Do a job.
Having thought about it for about 3 seconds, there is no non-funny answer to this question. They're all funny. Arteta funny, Klopp funny, Guardiola funny, Dyche incredible, Zisco Munoz. Imagine that.
Arteta, arguably the closest to his playing condition out of all 20
probably,
that I can think of.
Yeah, I would say so.
But
yeah.
What puts me off the idea is, can you imagine how earnestly his instructions would be given as he trots onto the pitch? He'd be pointing everywhere. He'd be doing so much pointing as he comes on, telling people what to do. That would actually genuinely annoy me. So in that case, I really hope it is him that has to re-register. So we've had players getting annoyed. We've had managers under pressure. We've had an element of hierarchy involvement here. But you know who we've forgotten about so far, Phil? And that's the fans, the most important people in football, except for the other lot and the others.
And I have to say, I think the point of no return in any crisis as a football club is without doubt when people start writing on bed sheets. And the more squint the writing gets, the more ferocious you can tell that their anger is. And I honestly think once bed sheets start to appear either outside the ground or particularly in the away end more than the home end, it's always the away end that does, you know, really does the damage. There's definitely no way back, ever.
It's something we take for granted, I think, Phil, bed sheets. We look at them and think, yeah, okay, on the face of it, they're quite an effective way of conveying a lot of indignant information all in one go. But it's the logistics of it that trouble me.
It's a battle getting it stretched out properly so you can actually see.
Huge. And they're really hard to write on in pen.
No, they are. So you tend to find that the letters are never the same size and the writing kind of goes like this. But as I say, I think the more hurried the writing looks, the more unhappy people are. And the other thing about bed sheets is that if you take a bed sheet to a game, you're guaranteed to get in the paper. Guaranteed.
That's partly what it is, in a sense. So, Jack, you are a disgruntled fan of Club X. You've turned up and you want to display this disgruntlement. Are you a bed sheet man? Are you a lamination man? Would you put two pieces of A4 together or even four?
A bit of paper just looks...
It's not enough, is it?
Yeah, I can't get behind a bit of paper. I think it has to be a bed sheet.
What colour? Just plain white?
White with black writing, yeah. As it happens, a friend of mine is currently sent me a message this morning saying he's working on his Cristiano Ronaldo not welcome here bed sheet to take to Man City against Arsenal tomorrow.
But that's probably another telltale sign. If you end up using a yellow one or like a blue one, then again, you've been in such a, you know, you're so desperate to get it done that you're not even bothered about the
colour.
Does
imply,
you know,
does imply desperation.
No quality control.
Yeah. For me, the classic moment of fan anger is team performs really badly in an away game, and you get this scene where the fans are furious, and then some of the players, like the good players, the earnest players, come over to the away end, do the hands up in the air thing to apologise, but the fans are so angry that they scream abuse, "You're not fit to wear the shirt." Yeah. At them, and the players are really upset about this. Well, the players who don't give a fuck, they're already back in the shower at this point. They've gone straight back into the dressing room. They're having, they're having the shower while they're more kind of hardworking, dedicated teammates. And they're getting screamed at by the 5,000 away fans. And that, to me, that is a classic vignette of crisis. I mean, the one that stands out to me when I was thinking up that scene was when Man City lost in the FA Cup at Ewood Park in March 2007 towards the end of the Stuart Pearce era. And the hatred there from the away end towards the City players was incredible.
Phil, I think even in kind of good times or unspectacular times, we shouldn't underestimate how little players genuinely care about fans at the end of a game. Because, like, you could win 2-0. You know, routine 2-0 win away from home. And one of the players is still dragging the other ones out of the tunnels, go over to the fans.
I find that
amazing.
It varies massively, doesn't it? I think when it comes to banners, though, banners usually target the board or the manager, don't they? They don't often...
Yeah, the bigger the banner, the more higher up the hierarchy they're going for.
I think that's probably true. And I mean, there must be time constraints as well. So you just write whatever. It reminds me of when...
Yeah, you don't want your banner to be out of date by the time you get to the game. That must be terrible.
But also, limited amounts of time to work on it. It always reminds me of those protests in Glasgow when Donald Trump became president and everybody was unhappy about his views on immigration and everything else. And somebody had got some cardboard and had just written, "Your ma was an immigrant, you fucking roaster." And I just thought to myself, they'd obviously sat down and gone, "I've only got half an hour to do this." That's fine, yeah. And as it turned out, it went viral because it was quite inspired, yeah.
Yeah, it's lovely. What I do like, I've only noticed this a few times over the years, Jack, especially with paper-based banners of protest, is when fans add little newspaper clippings for extra context. Which I just find really weird. It's like, we know what you're doing. We know what you're talking about. You don't need to put little pictures of it from a paper. I find that astonishing.
The classic one of these was, oh my God, what's his name? Matt Zari at Watford. There was a kind of I want to say elderly woman who had a big anti-Mazzari placard, and it's had all sorts of different messages and clippings on. Please leave Mr. Mazzari. Please get out of Watford. And then like pictures of when they'd lost games. It was amazing. It was a labour of love.
That even another little layer of intrigue when it comes to banners or general fan indignance, Phil, is when supporters refer to managers as Mr. Somebody.
This
weird kind of form of approach. It's like, so weird to do.
It's like an HR meeting, isn't it? Where everything's got to be done formally because you're about to sack him. And that thing at Watford, I mean, the funny thing is that he would actually have had to have gone over and looked at that closely to have properly got the... You know, if you've just got a banner saying... Blackwell out, as I remember that one down at Coventry in 2007, then it's pretty unambiguous, really, isn't it? You don't have to go over and go, what does that say? Oh, yeah, but if you've actually
at least fax it to the manager so he knows.
Yeah, if you've got newspaper cuttings, he would actually have to go over and say, just a minute, what is this about? Oh, yeah, okay.
So we've established then that banners in all forms are more or less a kind of vanity thing is just to get yourself in the papers on telly, but
also a massive tipping point.
Yeah. Oh, completely. Mm-hmm. There is an accumulative effect of them, but there is a more active way to demonstrate your indignance towards a manager. And I feel like this is more maybe final day of the season behaviour, Phil, and that is the throwing of season tickets. Do you think this is a dying art? I mean, technology seems to be kind of pushing it out of the equation.
It seems to be a safer strategy than throwing scarves, because throwing scarves always causes discontent. Some people don't like it. You know, that's when
you're never going to get a scarf more than 12 yards, are you?
People know why you're doing it, but you still shouldn't be doing it. There's etiquette and, you know, there are standards. I think with a season ticket, especially on the last day, I mean, you might as well, really.
I'm out of the loop in terms of ticketing technology, Jack, but they're digital tickets now, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't be throwing an £800 phone at a manager.
Yeah, well, I mean, last time I had a club membership card, it was like an Oyster card type thing, which is, I imagine, very hard to do.
You could whip it. You could whip it.
But that said, it can't be too long until people move to a kind of Apple Wallet style buzzing thing, and like no one's going to rip up their phone on
maybe
the pitch.
That's why.
Are you
delete
suggesting,
the app.
Delete... Are you suggesting a contactless display?
Yeah, maybe. Look at me. Delete the app. Take that.
Dugouts now with little readers on the side of them. Fans can queue up and just politely put their phone down and say, "Yes, I'd like to."
The manager.
I was looking this up earlier, and I saw that one manager. I don't know if you can guess who. Has had season tickets ripped up and thrown at him at two different clubs across a 10-year time span. It happened in 2006 and in 2016 at a different club in the same area.
Oh, God. That's such a big time span to have season tickets thrown at you. Brucey?
I was going to say Bruce.
Almost.
Oh, he had a lettuce thrown at him. Cabbage. It was cabbage.
I was just going to say, maybe the cabbage and Bruce was born of the fact that people no longer have season ticket books.
Maybe,
That's totally possible. All you've got to hand.
Maybe managers one day will have to scan. You know those little squares that you scan with your mobile phone, like the NHS app? You'll have to scan that and it'll give you all the list of complaints.
Exactly. Do you hate the board, the players, or the manager?
It's Steve McLaren, Middlesbrough 2006, Newcastle United 2016.
That is such a span of having... That's seriously very impressive endurance.
Just when you've put it behind you.
Yeah. fan protests very much. We're not very good at fan protests here, Phil, I would suggest. I mean, the banners, the bed sheets, the contactless phones. I feel like Italian fans do it better.
I was just going to say, you're thinking of the buses.
Why don't we turn up at training grounds over here?
And throw stones at the bus. Yeah.
Why don't we break into training grounds and force the players to explain what's going wrong? Well, we're not good enough at this stuff.
They've sensibly walked out over here that you might as well make them quite secure so that nobody can get within 300 yards of anything.
Yeah.
Whereas in Italy, they just kind of have chain fences, don't they? which people break through anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah, maybe we're just too polite over here. I'm not sure. So we reached tipping point here. Everything has gone wrong. You've lost the support of pretty much everybody. It almost feels like there's no way back. So it's time, Jack, for stage 9 of the club crisis, and that is the vote of confidence / club statement. I put it to you that club statements, the more granular, specific and paranoid they get, the better. Like when they start really citing individual things that have reportedly gone wrong, but they say, like, one newspaper says that ketchup wasn't available in the canteen. That is wrong. Wrong. It was available.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you always know with those kind of statements, or with any club statement, really, from the point of view of the club writing it, the shorter it is, the better it is. And you can all, as you go down the pyramid, the statements get longer. So it's really
Written directly. They cut out the middleman. There's no press
office. Yeah, so Chelsea issued a... Chelsea issued a famous vote of confidence in Mourinho in about October 2015, which is very good. It's very short. It's pretty clear. It's, you know, it's got, it's pro-Mourinho in some bits and anti-Mourinho in other bits. It finishes off by saying, "We believe that we have the right manager to turn the season around and that he has the squad with which to do it." So, you know, it's a really good statement. Whereas if you get down to an equivalent thing in, you know, let's say League One, League Two, it'll go on for 1,000 words. And you'll start complaining about, like, you know, the linesman decision at Accrington Stanley and our coach broke down on the way back from Torquay and all the rest
When there's bullet points. If a club statement includes bullet points, you know that you've reached a point of no return.
I feel like the dying out at the top level, to be honest. I feel like voter confidence is kind of outdated at the top level. The by a mile, the best in non-league. And normally, because they're written by the owner, and they always have this tone of, look, if you want to tear up, just come round and knock on my door and I'm quite happy to have one with you.
Imagine a Premier League club just doing that, saying, do you know what? Just turn up and knock on my door.
Yeah,
I live
let's
in
do that. But non-league is where they're best.
As part of this, you know, suggestion that the votes of confidence are a dying art at the top level, Jack, I wonder that surely clubs must be aware of the connotations of a vote of confidence in the wider footballing culture. Everyone knows that that's basically the beginning of the end. So maybe clubs are just thinking, well, it's not really worth us doing this anymore because people think it's just a bad thing.
Can I just jump
move.
In here and say,
sure,
there is actually now a modern style of a vote of confidence or a, you know, statement of a vote of confidence, and that is high-ranking people at clubs liking tweets.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, what kind of tweets?
Well, someone saying, this manager's hopeless, get rid of him. Or we should be doing much better with this squad. And you have the plausible deniability of saying, oh, it was just accidental. Really accidental. You'd have to commit, you know, you'd have to commit to 300 words on your website, which you can't get into reverse gear and pretend you never wrote.
I mean, is there a part of you that really hates writing about tweets being liked? Because you have to, you have to put it in speech marks, which is just the most cringiest thing ever.
Just writing about tweets, irrespective. There was a story up in Scotland the other week about Jermaine Defoe spotted in a restaurant, which translated as Jermaine Defoe posted a picture on Instagram of him in a restaurant.
I know, it's absolutely incredible. it's the kind of vehicle for football stories of social media is absolutely sensational. Also for club statements, Jack, I feel like we've killed off the corner flag. I'm genuinely proud of helping to bring it into the mainstream footballing culture, but I haven't seen a corner flag on a club statement for a very long time. And I do wonder if they're also quite self-aware about that too.
I kind of associate club statements with the front of the stadium or a like panoramic picture of an empty stadium.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of club fascias at stadiums now.
Yeah, just so it's distinctly of that club. And they can show off their fancy stadium while also looking somber as they break some bad news.
Yeah, it's arguably a more professional way of heading up a club statement. I'm all for it in a way, but it's sad to see the corner flags, the humble corner flag, removed from the equation. So, yeah, votes of confidence, club statements, that's when we're really reaching the kind of the real crescendo of a football club crisis.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Now we're at stage 10, Phil, the final stand. Quite literally, in fact, because when a manager is really doomed, and I feel like this is LMA-approved behaviour, when a manager is properly doomed, you'll see them standing right on the edge of their technical area, looking both stoic and powerless as their team lose 5-0 with 22% possession and no shots on target.
Barely moving.
When you know a manager's really done, when they're not doing anything.
Yeah,
they're just standing still.
They don't move. The arms are folded. They're pretending that they're not listening to the away end.
How many Leeds managers have you seen standing on the edge of their technical area doing nothing?
20? Yeah. No, I mean, we used to see one every 3 weeks at Pires and Chileno, you know, and became run of the mill, really. You're like, oh, here we go again. And there's always the comments as well. I always, it's like the thing with, signings and saying we'll only have players who are better than ours. Once managers start saying, well, it's ultimately not my decision, you think,
yeah,
it's going to be somebody else's decision in the morning, telling you that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm truly fascinated, Jack, by the language of a doomed football manager. It's they just turn into a kind of weird football language robot, and they start spitting out some very familiar phrases. Can you tell me some?
The classic is the overuse of the word football. You know, yeah. I'm only interested in winning football matches. I'm only here to win football matches, that kind of thing. There was I hate to go back to it yet again, but there was an amazing, I think, 7-minute Jose Mourinho rant after they lost 1-0 at home to Southampton. In October 2015, which, I mean, there's no point in me describing it. If you're listening to this, just look it up on YouTube. It's so good. Can I just test you and Phil out on what I think is my favourite bit of defiant manager talk that was not given by Jose Mourinho? So this was a manager soon before he was sacked in the Premier League era. And I think this sums up the kind of both the pomposity, but also the weakness of a manager who is about to get sacked.
Could we have a rough year?
10 years ago, give or take.
Okay.
Yeah.
No disrespect. So this is a manager who's been getting absolutely hammered all season.
You're going to say no disrespect here?
No disrespect to local MPs or local journalists or ex-players. But when you have got vastly experienced managers that are phoning me up and saying, under the circumstances, you're doing a marvellous job, then I will listen to them. Who said it? Just before he got sacked.
I can sense the tone, but I can't picture the face.
I want to say Joe Kinnear, but there are nowhere near enough C-bombs in it.
No, it's not Joe Kinnear.
It's not Kinnear-y.
Not too far away time-wise, Joe Kinnear back at Newcastle United, but it's not Joe Kinnear.
It's not going to be Allardyce, because Allardyce wouldn't be interested in other managers
calling
him up.
Agreed. He wouldn't care about what people are saying about him.
No, he wouldn't care about managers calling me up. I'll give you a clue. It's someone in the kind of Allardyce orbit, in the Sam Allardyce extended universe.
Oh, it was Steve Keane.
It was Steve Keane.
I was going to go for Phil Brown. Okay, fair enough.
Steve Keane, this is just before he got sacked at Blackburn. I think Steve Keane at Blackburn is one of the classic crises. You know, the fans hated him. They also hated Venkies. They kind of had to choose, are we against Steve Keane or Venkies? But they were against both. The football was terrible. The results were terrible. Awful players, relegated in a really pathetic, weak way.
What on earth were local MPs saying about Steve Keane?
Would it have been Jack Straw? Was he?
I don't know, I'll check Hansard.
Ah, yes, maybe.
I think people had said, I think the problem is that Steve Keane was such a Venkies yes man, and local MPs had said, what's happening at Blackburn Rovers is an absolute disgrace, and, you know, it was only a few years ago we were really good under Souness, and now we're rubbish. And Steve Keane took umbrage at it being suggested that he shouldn't have been manager of Blackburn.
I feel like it completely undermines all the other examples I had of generic defiant football manager attacks. That is absolutely note perfect. You could have also have had, I've never walked away from anything in my life and I'm not going to start now, which is, it, again, is in the LMA handbook for managers you think they might be sacked in. I've never heard a manager say, do you know what, I've given up on loads of stuff before. I'm really thinking about doing it again. I can't be arsed at this.
It's such a ridiculous thing to say that, because it's like, people walk away from stuff all the fucking time. They just don't walk away from stuff when the cost of walking away is not getting a massive £1 million payout. Like, how many times a day do you walk away from stuff? You walk away from the too long a queue at Starbucks, and yet I'm not going to walk away from the Crystal Palace job because I want to get sacked and get paid.
I mean, again, to return to him, I'm pretty sure Mourinho is the only manager I've ever heard who actually directly references his potential payout before he gets sacked. He says, well, I'm not going anywhere. Because absolutely understandably, anyone would be able to get their head around this. I'm going to get paid loads of money if I don't walk away. That's kind of not fair enough, but it's the reality of the situation. And who else would argue with that? You could have also had, I'm the manager of this football club until told otherwise.
Yes,
I really like that. Because
yeah.
He's basically laying out the bare facts that everybody knows.
It's also the lines that start to dry up. So once they stop talking about working hard on the training pitch to turn it around, you know that line of defence is no longer of any use to them. You know.
Yeah, when they get a little bit sort of petulant in the press conferences, and you get the sense that you're about to see 90 minutes of them standing on the edge of their table.
I've been in football long enough to know.
I'm big enough and ugly enough.
That was what when Slaven Bilic was obviously about to get sacked by West Ham, deserved to get sacked by West Ham, but Sullivan and Gold, for whatever reason, couldn't quite pull the trigger. The last few months, you know, they get beaten 3-0 at home to like Huddersfield, and it would be so shit. And then afterwards, Billet just say, "Yeah, I've been in football long enough to know what's going on here."
Yeah, when they start getting really philosophical.
Yeah, and also, it. I'll take responsibility, but is always classic of the genre, really.
That this is just after they claim as their final act of defiance that they relish / thrive on the pressure.
Yes.
And it turns out that is absolutely not the case. I really could do without this, actually. Nobody thrives on
getting absolutely berated by 5,000 people for 90 minutes.
Yeah, if you didn't enjoy the pressure, then you wouldn't be doing this job for a start, I have to say. Complete bullshit. Complete lies. And we've heard them all. So that's the final stand for a manager. So inevitably, I'd give it a good week max. That manager is getting sacked, Jack. And there are three things. There's kind of a hierarchy of things you may see in their statement when they get sacked, depending on how warmly received they have been at the club. Thanks for their efforts. That's the standard. Everyone should get thanked for their efforts, regardless of how little effort they've put in. Then the next level is wished well for the future. That means you've kind of done your best, but you weren't good enough. And then if you really are kind of cruelly sacked, but you maybe just couldn't take the team to the next level, then you are welcome back at Stadium X in the future. But that's really only for the really warmly regarded ones. But yeah, thanks for your efforts is the bare minimum, Phil.
Who was the club recently, and I may be making this up, whose statement amounted to bye?
I'd really like to see it.
Five words long. Such and such has left the club.
Yeah.
Which, to be quite honest, in a lot of cases, would just be for the best, really. Mm. You know, I mean, I hate mutual consent. Mutual consent's dreadful. Never mutual consent. It's always somebody's decision, you know, even if everybody can see that it's all going wrong. But yeah, no, there's always the word tirelessly in it as well, isn't there? You've always worked tirelessly, never just hard or, you know.
Absolutely, to turn the results around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think there's a similar hierarchy for manager statements released via the LMA? You know, sometimes they'll have been like they'll obviously be very proud of their work. Sometimes they'll be like bitterly upset not to be able to complete the work that we started.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, always being sad not to be able to finish what they started.
Yes.
Definitely. Yeah, sad to see. Before, you know, supporters were great, which is again a massive lie. But in so many circumstances like this, Phil, you know, it's the middle of the season. It's not an ideal time to be bringing in a new manager. You have to bring in your caretaker, and that's stage 12 of a crisis. Because I feel like that's the dying embers of a crisis is when you have to bring in a caretaker manager, because they're very rarely ideal people. I'd say there's three types: the firefighter, the fan's favourite, or the adventurous interim.
Yeah, plus the academy manager who doesn't really want to.
Yeah, it's a new real job.
He's told, look, get on with it. You know, you need
the bloke we already employ. Yes,
I mean,
good.
The firefighter is basically the self-styled Red Adair of football, Neil Warnock. Mm. Yeah, you get him in to save you from relegation in the Championship, and then you buy, you know, Sol Bamba, and you have a promotion push the following season.
Exactly.
That's the strategy. So yeah, I would say it falls to the firefighter. The academy manager, which could sort of be the fans' favourite sometimes, or yes, the kind of off the wall punt, which never worked.
Yeah, true. Yeah, sort of, you know, foreign random as your caretaker manager. Really, I quite like that bold approach, Jack. Because it kind of gets fans thinking, maybe this guy is the one. And you're always going to get a long read out of an adventurous foreign manager as well before they start.
Yeah, that's why you have to implore the style of Chelsea in not once but twice getting Gus Hiddink in as their caretaker. I imagine that Chelsea could get more or less anyone in the world in to be caretaker manager because it's Chelsea and they've got money.
Yeah.
And, you know, or they could have done it cheap. They could have got someone from the academy. They could have got, you know, an ex-player, but they went high end and got Hiddink. My favourite interim appointment was when Manchester City sacked Roberto Mancini after the 2013 FA Cup final, and they brought in Brian Kidd for the last few games of the season. Now, of course, Kidd is a very natural fit here in the sense that he's a fan's favourite. He's been at City in various coaching capacities for a long time, long coaching career, played for City with great distinction in the 1970s. But in the Manchester City statement with which they sacked Mancini in 2013, they said they wanted a manager with a, quote, more holistic approach, which is the word that I've never seen in any other club statement before or since, which led to the City fans dubbing themselves for their kind of three games at the very end of that season as, quote, Brian Kidd's holistic army.
Oh, God.
It's quite clever, that, though.
Will live long in the memories of any City fans from that period.
Yeah, because nobody knows what holistic means. You can appoint anybody and say, well, you know, like we're just sticking to
the famously holistic Manuel Pellegrini.
Steve Bruce, you know, holistic. I think he was only caretaker at Leeds twice, but it felt as if Neil Redfern was breaking the record for a number of caretaker stints, because Leeds used to sack managers once a month. And bless him, he was the academy manager, and it was always a case of, you're back again, crack on.
I don't envy that job, even if you are already employed by the club and kind of know the ethos and what's going on. The idea that you then have to go and start watching loads of DVDs of your upcoming opponents. I can't be arsed with this.
No, and
I was in the canteen the other day. I don't need this.
You're kind of on a Hayden. You're kind of got a free hit because you can always go, it's not my team. But there's no such thing as a free hit when a club's in crisis. Mm. Everybody's looking for people to bun.
Got to hit the ground running. Was Redfern a catch-up man or a no catch-up man?
Good question. I'll ask him next time we speak. I'm gonna say a catch-up man.
Yeah, he strikes me as very catch-up-y. Yeah, that's all
so.
I'm saying.
I think
yeah.
so.
Yeah. Based on nothing. Now, I did say there were 12 stages of a club crisis. That's a nice tidy number. But Phil, you've thrown a spanner in the works. You want to offer us a bonus 13th stage.
The 13th stage of this is the appointment of the next manager, provided it makes you go, really?
Yeah.
So I'm going to take you back to 2015. I think it was John Percy at the Telegraph who broke this. And the tweet went something like this. Uwe Rosler, sacked by Leeds. Steve Evans currently driving into the training ground.
Nice touch of telling us where he was at the time. That's cool.
Well, I think Steve Evans was basically sat outside waiting for Rosler to leave because he'd already been appointed. And once Rosler made his exit, Evans made his entrance. And that was one of those moments where you thought, this doesn't look like getting better anytime soon.
It's very much the final few minutes of a Netflix series, like the teaser for the next series.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, this one's going to be all about this bloke, Steve Evans. Or like a character getting out of a taxi in EastEnders and you can only see their feet. And you think, oh no, now it's all going to go down. Yeah, that's never good. Yeah,
no.
never good.
No, and it's happened a few other places as well. I suspect Newcastle and Steve Bruce was a little bit like that, people thinking, wasn't really what we were thinking of, but you know.
Yeah, bad times are still coming. So I want to leave you both with this question, because I feel it's important that we tidy this up at the very end. What is the most comprehensive Premier League crisis? Jack, I feel like you are going to say the Mourinho season.
It's all there.
But it doesn't have its own Wikipedia page like Doing a Leeds has.
I don't, maybe the Doing a Leeds is a bit before my time, but I just think the Mourinho season was so complete. You know, they were the best team in the country and they were spectacularly bad very quickly and absolutely. And there was no... You know, it had all the ingredients. And it has this kind of like mystical element to it as well. Like it was so spectacular that I think it's not, it can be quite difficult to explain. So for me, that is the classic definitive Premier League crisis.
It's up there, but Phil, I mean, you don't just have one Leeds crisis, you have two at least.
But not Premier League, you see.
However,
if you think anything beats the Ridsdale demise, go back and watch the press conference of him sitting next to Terry Venables. Look at Venables' body language and ask yourself if there's ever been a more awkward room in the history of Premier League football.
Mm.
There hasn't.
Yeah, the whole concept of doing a Leeds in its original sense, was that a crisis? Or was it kind of just a kind of crumbling, you know, the death of a dream? Like, I suppose it is. There are elements of crisis there.
You wouldn't say that the Roman Empire, when it fell apart, was a crisis, really, was it? It was like sort of natural development. There were periods of severe crisis, at least. But I think when it goes on for a really, really sustained length of time, i.e. almost 20 years, you kind of have to say that it's something else entirely, really.
Yeah, agreed. Oddly, I thought Arsenal... I was looking back through the examples of Premier League crises, Jack. I don't think Arsenal have had a proper one, because they are the masters of having like tiny little brief crises and then plucking a 4-0, 5-0 win out of nowhere and then saying, crisis? What crisis? Arsenal are so good at crisis, what crisis? They are the kings of crisis, what crisis?
Well, on a kind of micro level, it's a series of mini crises, you know?
Yeah.
Over the course of the last few years, it's been a mini crisis, a mini crisis, a mini crisis, a mini crisis. And after each mini crisis, they'd win a few games, and the mini crisis is over, and then the next one will come along. On a macro level, it's one massive crisis.
Yes.
It's been one massive crisis since, I don't know, since they sold Ashley Cole, or since the Eduardo Birmingham game, or the 2011 League Cup final, or choose any point from you know, the last 10, 15 years, and you could say that's when the kind of macro crisis started. So it depends on your scope, really, the size of the crisis.
Well, the thing about Arsenal is that they've done all 13 stages of a club crisis, but never all in the same season. They've never managed to pull it all together. They've never had the kind of cohesive crisis that, say, Chelsea
have. They haven't had a sufficiently self-contained, unified crisis. And that's the beauty of the Mourinho season, is it was a crisis. The beginning, middle and end of the crisis was 5 months. Mm. Whereas with Arsenal, it's this perming state of rolling mega crisis. It's different.
Yeah. Also, out with Arsenal fan TV, they don't ever make anybody care. You know, like the crisis never makes you kind of want to see what's going on next. You always hear about it. And if you, you know, you sat in the pub, you can say, ah, what about Arsenal? But, you know, you're not, it's not like when Leeds were falling apart and everybody seemed to be totally fixated on it. And it was just this endless rolling story that
people... It's never an end point. There's never an end point with the Arsenal crisis.
And it's never that dramatic, is it?
Yeah, I would even say that they've probably done all 13 stages individually better than anybody else, but they've never managed to do them all at the same time. So, yeah, Arsenal, fascinating case. And I'm sure we've covered everything now. We've done it. We've done the football crisis. That's it. We've nailed it. I want this to be the textbook.
If you want to be a club in crisis, listen to this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Managers, chairman, fans, you're all going to get something out of this. You might feel slightly less about yourself in the process, but that doesn't matter. It's something I've always wanted to nail down, and I couldn't have picked two better people than Mr. Leeds, Phil Hay, and Jack Pickpook, crisis magnet. So thanks to you, Phil. A sensational debut.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it. You might have me back on.
I certainly will. A pleasure to have you. Thanks to you, Jack.
My pleasure.
See you again soon. Cheers to everyone. Look forward to your badge cracking and your ketchup replacing and your Carabao Cup upsetting. It'll all happen to you one day. See ya.
The Athletic.